A database tracking the path of every pain pill sold to pharmacies in the United States was recently made public by the Drug Enforcement Administration. The Washington Post sifted through the data to find that drug companies distributed over 76 billion oxycodone and hydrocodone pills over the course of 7 years, reshaping the public's understanding of the role that drug companies, distributors, and pharmacies have played in this crisis. In October, we'll see the first case of consolidated lawsuits by some 2,000 plaintiffs against drug companies go to trial in Ohio. My next guest says that that's the largest civil trial in U.S. history, and it's set to be a major legal test of how much responsibility can be laid at the feet of drug companies for the opioid crisis. Lenny Bernstein is health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post. Lenny, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this huge database. What did the data tell us about the opioid crisis, especially in its early days?
Well, we knew that there were a lot of opioids being shipped around this country. What we didn't know is that there were 76 billion, with a B, shipped between 2006 and 2012. That is a number that I, even covering this for the past several years, had no idea about. I had no idea it was going to be that large. We don't know how many of those were diverted to illicit use in the on the street, but let's say it's 1%. That's 760 million pills. That's just an incredible amount.
Now, how and who was responsible for distributing these pills? Was it the drug companies, the pharmacies, the doctors? Like who and how did these pills make it to the market and to ultimately to Americans?
All of the above. The manufacturers produce them. There are distribution companies. That group is dominated by three major companies, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen. They go to the drugstores. Of course, we all know the big chains among the drugstores, but also to mom and pops and small individual private drugstores. And then, of course, if the system is working correctly, you can't walk into one of those drugstores and buy an opioid without a prescription from your doctor. So there are four parts to the chain, basically, and that's how opioids are supposed to get to legitimate users.
Now, do we know, were there any specific geographic or demographic trends that stood out to you when you looked at the data? Were there certain communities that saw higher levels of the distribution of hydrocodone and oxycodone pills, for example?
It's roughly the way we have come to understand it over the years. Appalachia, West Virginia, New England, some of the northern Midwestern states have been hit very hard. But of course, we knew that anecdotally. We could go to those places and see the number of overdose deaths and the level of addiction in those places. We also saw little pockets. There's a pocket in Nevada or a county here or there in another state that maybe didn't come to our attention. And then, of course, we've had CDC data now for years that's shown the escalating use of these prescription opioids as well as heroin and fentanyl in the second and third waves of the epidemic.
Why are we only getting access to this data now?
The DEA has been keeping it for many, many years, but it's been under wraps. It's been kept private. Their argument was that this was not public data. The drug companies were very, very zealous in trying to keep this information under wraps. Their argument was that if it got out, then it could give their competitors an advantage. So all the drug companies were claiming that this was proprietary. The Washington Post and the Charleston Gazette Mail sued back in 2016 when these legal cases started moving forward. And we said, this is information that the public has a right to have. We lost at the federal level, but we won at the appellate court. The appellate court judge told Judge Polster, who was overseeing that giant federal case that you referred to make this information available, and also some of the filings that have been put in that court case.
Some of the posts, the Washington Post reporting talks about internal drug company emails, which are showing, I guess you could say, indifference by top executives to opioid addiction and deaths. Can you give us some more on that? Why did the companies, was this really about profit over people?
It appears that way to some people. We had the example of the executive at Mallinckrodt, the largest manufacturer of opioids, telling someone, just like Doritos, you know, keep eating, we'll keep making them. We had several examples in our reporting over the past 10 days in which people at various points in the chain, the compliance chain at these various companies would say, gosh, that is an awful lot of opioids. Can that possibly be legit? And then generally they would be told, don't worry about it. You know, we're shipping. That needs to go out. They need those drugs. Now, sure, plenty of legit users out there, people in very serious pain from cancer, end of life care, the things that opioids are intended for. But when you are a company and you can see that you are shipping millions of pills to one pharmacy in a town of 400 people, you're supposed to stop that and warn the DEA. And that didn't happen. And that didn't happen over and over and over again.
Lenny, have the drug companies responded to this report so far?
So far, they have issued a variety of responses. Their main one is that the doctors are mostly responsible because doctors write prescriptions. Opioids can't be issued without a prescription. That is true. A rogue doctor who is willing to sell his prescription pad can do an awful lot of damage, but he doesn't have the view from 30,000 feet that the companies had.
Sounds like a little bit of passing of the buck.
There's culpability all along the supply chain, but the law makes the distributors responsible for flagging the suspicious orders and telling the DEA.
Lenny Bernstein covers health and medicine for The Washington Post. Lenny, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.